one case on this docket this morning, and it's the case of Silwa versus the Commonwealth. We're ready when council is ready. And if you've not already done so, please take a moment and sign the sign-in sheets.
May it please the court. My name is Shalev Ben Avraham, and I rep from the Fairfax County Office of the Public Defender, and I represent Ms. Silwa. Your Honors, I would request to reserve at least 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes, yes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, this case is, quite frankly, I think, very simple at this point, as it's conceded by the Attorney General's office that the interpanel accord doctrine requires this court to find that Ms. Silwa's conviction should be overturned for the probation violation, as it was a void order. This court in Wilson dealt with the exact same issue and specifically found that when the trial court lost, or when probation ended and the trial court entered an extension of probation, even though Mr. Wilson had agreed to it, but it was entered after probation had ended, that the trial court lost jurisdiction to do that.
What about the one-year extension that the code provides?
Well, Your Honor, that is a very good point, but that only provides a one-year extension when there is a revocation hearing addressed. So what happened was, prior to the change in that code section, which is in 19.2.306 subsection B, there was this sort of, there was a court case in which said that because a defendant wasn't brought for revocation until after his probation had ended, the court was without jurisdiction on that. The legislature fixed that. And the legislature added to 306B this idea that we have a year from when probation ends to file a revocation hearing or process on you for something you did during the probationary period. And it's sometimes confusing, but the 306 analysis is really not important to this case at all. And the reason for that is that the extension of probation that occurred did not occur through a revocation hearing.
You're talking about the September hearing.
There was no hearing in September. The September order, correct.
I might be jumping ahead a little on you here, but what about the fact that then in December there was a hearing?
Correct. And this is where the Commonwealth seems to think that we have sort of double talk, but we're not. That was a probation violation. She was found in violation of probation. We're not challenging that was, in fact, accurate. But when you look at the order that was actually entered in January from that December hearing, the order specifically says that the court further ordered that the defendant remain under the same terms and conditions of supervised probation. So that leaves really only two ways to look at this. First, this remain under refers to the void order, because that's what kept her on probation, because her probation ended in August of 2009. So the only reason to say remain under would be referring to that void order. And that is more likened to other cases that we've had, such as Carbaugh versus the Commonwealth, which says that probation, the period of suspension, good behavior, they're all distinct and separate concepts in the probation realm. And we have to look at each one individually. And in those cases, there are, when the court entered, for example, 3 years of suspended time, so 3 years of a jail sentence, suspended for 3 years with 2 years of active probation, or perhaps 4 years of active probation is a better example. 4 years of active probation, once the suspended sentence lapsed, the period for which the suspended sentence lapsed, then no longer is the rest of that year, that extra year of active probation, valid. And I think Your Honor recognized that in the other Silwa case when you wrote the opinion stating exactly that. Your Honor.
But counsel, the other Silwa case had some different facts.
Agreed, Your Honor, absolutely. But I was just going to the point regarding when you have these distinct concepts. So the probationary period, when a probationary period is, say, 4 years, but the suspended period of the jail sentence is only for 2 years, that remaining 2 years is ineffective. And that's what we have here. Even if you find the probation violation in 2009 to be valid, the continuation of probation from that order is ineffective because the initial order putting her on probation on September of 2009 was void. And that is where the lack of jurisdiction
void or
occurred.
Void,
void, Your Honor. And
how do you get to void? I mean, there was subject matter jurisdiction. Subject matter jurisdiction remained. It may have not been active jurisdiction over that individual. But
well,
doesn't that make it voidable?
Your Honor, we disagree with that, and I'll explain why. And this is exactly what the Wilson court dealt with. The Wilson panel had the exact same facts and found that once probation ended, active jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction is gone. You may have been able to do a probation violation, and I want to unpack this a little bit. And I want to really reference the court to 17.1-513, which the Commonwealth cites as creating this sort of subject matter jurisdiction. And in paragraph 3, near the bottom of it, is where we get jurisdictions for the circuit court over felonies. And what it specifically says is, they shall also have, and they referring to the circuit court, shall also have original jurisdiction of all indictments for felonies and of presentments, informations, and indictments for misdemeanors. There's no comma after felonies, just as we know that can be a problem. When you issue a bench warrant, that is not an indictment for a probation violation. So this code section, if the court were even to say that this is what grants the jurisdiction, as the Commonwealth suggests, it does not, because that code section is very clear that the circuit court only has original jurisdiction of felonies that are indictments. When you are coming back before the circuit court on a probation violation, you're coming before that court not on an indictment, but on a bench warrant. And so now we have to look at code sections 303, 192, 303, 304, and 306 to determine what the jurisdiction of the trial court is at that point over the probation violation. And what we really see is there's two things. As we addressed, Your Honors, 192.306 deals with revocations, and there is a time limit, a statute of limitations that has been put in there that says they have to at least file the revocation report or the bench warrant within 1 year from when probation ends. 304 is a completely different statute. 304 is about modifying, decreasing, increasing, changing conditions of probation without going through the probation violation sort of revocation process. And in that, there is supposed to be minimum due process given, which is supposed to be at least notice to everyone in a hearing. It does not appear that a hearing was done in this case, but that argument is not really where I'm going with this.
Because there was due process if we take into account the December 17 hearing. There was notice, there was hearing opportunity to be heard.
On that probation violation, yes, Your Honor, but there was no notice or hearing done to increase her probation indefinitely back in September of 2016 when the court signed off on the order. But that's really not sort of my argument, is not that there was a lack of due process, because candidly she had signed a voluntary waiver, which I think would have waived her due process right to have that hearing and notice.
Counsel, what about the Muhammad case?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's exactly what I'm trying to get to. I think the distinction, and doesn't seem to have been raised in the Muhammad case, is that when we look at this code section, 17.1-513, it does not raise the issue that the circuit court has jurisdiction in perpetuity over everyone. It only has original jurisdiction over indictments for felonies, and that's not what we have here. And that gets me back to 304 and sort of 306. In the Brown case, which I cited in my briefing, the Supreme Court said that when two statutes are in conflict, we look to the one that is more specific on this matter. In Brown, it was an issue of use of a firearm, which carries a three-year mandatory minimum, and a juvenile who'd been certified. And there's a juvenile statute about sentencing, which says that essentially a circuit court judge can sentence a juvenile either to a juvenile when they've been certified, juvenile disposition, all the way up to an adult disposition. What the Supreme Court said is, well, Brown was convicted of use of a firearm, and there's a specific language when use of a firearm is used that there's a three-year mandatory minimum, and the court did have to impose that. And so that becomes more specific. So when we look at 17.1-513, and then we look at 192-304, 304 is the more specific statute to increase, decrease any type of probation. Now, 192.304 does not have a time limitation on it. And I would suggest to the court that makes perfect sense, because You can't increase, decrease, change, modify, or otherwise deal with something that no longer exists. So once probation ends, 19.2.304 in of itself is no longer a useful mechanism to do anything. And that's what we have here. What we have here is probation ended on August 14th at exactly 12 noon, 11:59.
Well, that gets to your contract issue, right?
And that also gets to that, Your Honor. If this court does find that that was the September 16th order by the court was valid, then I would say that when we get to Ms. Silva's revocation in March of 2015, she had already satisfied the condition subsequent of what she did, which was requiring her to take care of her pending charges, do a drug treatment program, and an aftercare. And that was all agreed to and put into the record that by the end of January 2013, she completed that. And when you look at the order that was entered by the court, it makes reference to that she's extending her probation for the purpose of dealing with the pending charges, to do a drug treatment program, and to an aftercare program.
Didn't it also include a be of good behavior provision?
The order actually did not necessarily do that. I would say, though, Your Honor, that I think implicit in every sentence is the idea of good behavior. I think so. I'm not really making an issue of that, but I would point out that the case law says that good behavior is a separate term from an act of probation, which is a separate term from a suspended sentence, which is a separate term from when a suspended sentence is suspended for a period of time.
But counsel, how do you get past the Richardson case in the Supreme Court that basically talks about how you don't look at these things in the terms of a contract?
And normally I would agree with that, Your Honors. And the reason for that is that when someone is put on probation, they're given it's the grace of the court to help rehabilitate. She was already placed on probation. Her probation was ending, and an agreement was reached between her, the court, and probation to extend that probation in lieu of not having a probation violation charged against her at that time. And for her to do these things in the court to give her that ability to go through those programs. It is true that Ms. Silva was given a major benefit. But legally, when a court still acts without jurisdiction, we have to come back to that. But specifically to your point, Your Honor, regarding, and I see that I don't want to go too far over on this and save some rebuttal time, but that is when you're first placed on probation. That is not a contract. That's the grace of the court. We are past that. We are on probation, and she makes a specific agreement to have her probation extended indefinitely and that's what the order says, until these things are done.
But you'll admit that this is kind of a unicorn.
Yes,
This is not a guilty plea. This is not, you know, in the context of a guilty plea, it's not exactly in the context of probation.
Correct. I agree, Your Honor. And I think that's what makes this distinct on that aspect. But I would just point out again that under the inter-panel accord doctrine, the Commonwealth has conceded this court should follow the holding of Wilson and the Wilson panel and reverse the conviction. And I would just reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Shanderville?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Chris Shanabel on behalf of the Commonwealth in this appeal. I guess I'll begin with a point of agreement, which is that I think, unfortunately, from the Commonwealth's perspective, this case is simpler than we would like it to be due to the interpanel accord doctrine, due to a panel of this Court's decision in Wilson. As I've argued on brief, I think Wilson was wrongly decided. I think the reasoning in Wilson flatly contradicts the reasoning of another published decision of this Court in Muhammad.
What about the Dunham case?
The Dunham case?
Aren't Dunham and Wilson contrary to one another?
I think they are, Your Honor. And I think in Wilson, the panel of this court flatly misconstrued, not intentionally, but flatly misconstrued Dunham, in holding that what Dunham said was that you can challenge.
So we have two decisions of this court, and they're contrary to one another in the respect that would...
At least three, Dunham, Muhammad, and Wilson. Now, Wilson is the most recent decision from a panel of this court. Wilson is also the most factually analogous decision. I mean, it's on all fours factually.
But don't you argue that we don't have to get to any of that discourse if we take your second argument?
I do, Your Honor.
So why don't you tell us about that?
I'm happy to do so.
Since we're essentially a pass-through on the Wilson issue.
Right. And
if we end up going that direction.
It's a difficult question under the interpanel court doctrine, not one I was able to satisfy myself with, because when you have conflicting decisions of this court, what is the panel of this court to do? And sometimes the best result might be to just take the case en banc and fix, notwithstanding the alternative argument I've made, because we're going to have Wilson as a published decision of the panel of this court, which, as I've said, is wrongly decided on a very important issue of subject matter jurisdiction. We think that is an issue that should be corrected. However, this
Supreme
panel,
Court chose not to take it, though.
You all didn't
file cross appeal on that.
Well, at the time, Wilson hadn't been decided, so there was nothing to cross appeal at the time because
when you went to the Supreme Court?
Correct. When the petition for appeal was filed at the Supreme Court,
okay,
there's no opportunity to file a petition for cross appeal.
Right.
And honestly, I don't know how we would have assigned error to what the panel did in that respect. But we did argue in the Supreme Court, you should take this opportunity to overrule Wilson, and I thought seemed to be getting some traction at oral argument, but in the order that came out from the Supreme Court, the order said because there was only one assignment of error and it only went to the issue of mootness, we're not going to reach that issue at this time. If the opportunity presents itself to present that issue to the court again under proper assignment of error, we'll certainly do that. But that wasn't any judgment on the merits of whether Wilson was or was not correct. It was just the court was constrained by the assignment of error limited to mootness. So we do think that the court ultimately would overturn based on the court's precedent. And we do think that this full court sitting en banc should overturn Wilson based on this court's prior precedent and the Supreme Court's prior precedent. And because of that reason, because we've kind of conceded that case, Wilson is at least factually the most on point, even though the reasoning flatly contradicts those other decisions. This court doesn't need to reach the contractual argument that my opposing counsel has made today. That only goes to that September order, which we're conceding that Wilson requires this court to hold was an error. Those contractual arguments, I'll just note for the court, are based on really misstatements of the record. The order entered by the court was an order extending probation indefinitely or until further order of the court. It was not an order entered until Ms. Sealwell completed the terms of her probation. That's at page 21 of the record. So the contractual arguments fail on the plain reading of the court's order, and notwithstanding the fact that what the Commonwealth or the probation officer had said previously, the order itself, and the court speaks through its order, the court subsequently interpreted its order and said we extended probation indefinitely or until further order of the court, not until some sort of substance abuse treatment was completed or whatnot. But this court need not decide that issue in this case and need not really decide the Wilson issue because this court can and should affirm this probation violation based on the continuance of Ms. Sealwell's probation indefinitely, which occurred as a result of that December 17th hearing and the resulting order on January 28th of 2010. What Ms. Sealwell has conceded today is that probation violation resulted from proper process, notice of a hearing was held, and she was found in violation of her probation. She concedes today that was a proper violation. She's not challenging that violation. And what the court said in the resulting order entered in January of 2010, and that's that order is at pages 30 through 31 of the record. What the court said in that order is the defendant admitted to the violations as alleged. This is page 31. The court found the defendant in violation, ordered none of the suspended sentence to be revoked, and ordered into execution. And then down at the bottom of the paragraph, the court further ordered that the defendant remain under the same terms and conditions of supervised probation. And if you read up a few paragraphs at the very top of that page, that order, the court noted that in September that order had been entered, ordering that her probation be extended indefinitely. So what Ms. Sealwell is arguing, and I think what Wilson requires, unfortunately, this panel to hold, is that September order was entered in error. So the court couldn't have extended her probation through that September order due to the fact that there was no hearing held. However, what the court is saying in this January order is we're finding you in violation now, and she admits that's a valid probation violation, and we're continuing you on probation under the same terms and conditions that are currently in place, and references back to that indefinite extension of probation. And so I think, and that probation violation was based on, if you look at the probation officer's letter, and if you look at the bench warrant that was issued, based at least in part on new charges that had occurred in June of 2009. So prior to that initial August 2009 expiration of the probation, prior to that order that she's challenging on appeal, extending probation. Those new charges occurred prior to that, and she's being found in violation of probation based on those new charges, and having been continued on probation indefinitely as a result of that. So the argument on appeal basically comes down to, as I understand, De Silva's argument. The argument seems to be, well, because the January order resulted from the December hearing, because that order incorporates by reference the September order extending probation indefinitely, that incorporation by reference was ineffective, and so the court couldn't have done what it was trying to do. In other words, the court couldn't have continued the Ms. Silva on probation indefinitely merely because the court incorporated by reference that prior order.
Well, isn't part of his argument that you can't continue something that somebody's not on? Well, so she's not on probation at the time that it's entered.
I think the argument is you can't continue someone on probation if they're not on it without doing this hearing. So he concedes that even if probation has expired, within 1 year thereafter, if you come into court, have a hearing, you can find someone in violation of their probation based on offenses that occurred while that probation was ongoing. That's exactly what happened in December. We had a hearing. It was based, at least in part, on offenses that occurred during that probationary period before it was extended indefinitely. Court said, I find you in violation, and I continue you on probation under the same terms and conditions, referencing back to that order extending it indefinitely.
So let me ask you a question. What I'm hearing you say is that because of these various conflicts in the different opinions of this court that are out there, it would be the Commonwealth's preference to have the court hear this en banc, but this alternate argument seems to be the best and narrowest.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I think from the Commonwealth's perspective, we didn't feel like we were in a position to tell, without any case law to support the argument, to tell the court how it should resolve that conflict between those cases under the interpanel court doctrine. And so that, for that reason, we're advancing this alternative argument and suggesting that if the court intends to resolve that difference, difference between the case law, the court can take the case en banc. And we do think it's a issue worthy of an en banc hearing to resolve the decision in Wilson.
But how would we get past the best and narrowest if we agree with your alternate argument?
Well, I think that there are times when this court has taken a case en banc sua sponte without issuing a panel decision. And so if the court is going to issue a panel decision in this case, the court would have to say, first of all, assuming without deciding Wilson controls as of the September order, we're going to reach the alternative argument as to the December hearing, the January order, and affirm on that basis. So that's how a panel decision of this court could read. Now, the court could, in the alternative, take the case en banc sua sponte without issuing that panel decision. But that's something that we put at the discretion of the court. I didn't feel like without any case law to support that argument, the interpanel court doctrine is not an argument.
You're using the one-year grace period, and this subsection B of 192.306 was in effect at the time?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And I think that's why Ms. Steele concedes that probation violation was proper. They had a hearing within that 1 year. It was based on violations that allegedly occurred prior to the expiration of her probation. And so she concedes in both briefs, that probation violation should stand. What she's trying to do is to split the baby and say that, well, while the probation violation in that order stands, the continuing her on probation indefinitely in that order does not stand. But the Commonwealth would submit that you can't split those different sections of that order, certainly not just because there was a reference back to that earlier September order. What the Circuit Court could have done in that, after that December hearing, the court certainly could have said, and I think Ms. Sully would have to concede this, certainly could have said, I find you in probation, and from this point forward, I continue you on probation indefinitely. The court could have said that.
Could have said that because there was time hanging over her head that the court could have imposed instead.
Correct, Your Honor. But the argument from Ms. Sully was that because the court relied on a prior extension order that the court at the time thought was a valid order and kind of incorporated it by reference and says we're continuing you on those same terms and conditions, that somehow this court has to prevent this court's order from being interpreted in a manner consistent with the circuit judge's intent and interpreted differently because of that mere reference to the prior order. We would submit that this court should not interpret the order in that way. And I think this court's decision in Wright versus Commonwealth is authority for that, that the court relies on the intention of the order sometimes the order is somewhat ambiguous, and so you can look to the record and see what was the court's intent. In the Wright case, again, a decision from published decision from this court, in the year 2000. In that case, the orders at issue were these revocation orders continuing the defendant on under the same terms and conditions. And the argument from the defendant was, well, because she was continued on, or he was continued on the same terms and conditions, that was really just a reference back to the original sentencing order. And so since that original sentencing order had a 5-year term of suspension, those 5 years are still running from that original order because that was the order incorporated by reference. And what this court said in Wright was, no, when the court subsequently said, we're continuing you under the same terms and conditions, it started a whole new 5-year term of suspension. And so that's what we're arguing here, is that when the court referred back to that order continuing her on probation indefinitely, the court starting a whole new term of indefinite probation from that point forward. So we think Wright does control the interpretation of that January order that resulted from that December hearing. And for that reason, this court should affirm that probation violation on that alternative ground and need not resolve the Wilson issue. Unless there are any further questions from the court, I'm happy to rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honors, I would make reference and have the court look to that order from January of 2010, and specifically on, it's the Appendix 30 and 31, specifically at the top of the page, and the Commonwealth says this, on September 16, 2009, the court ordered that the defendant's period of supervised probation be extended indefinitely in order for the defendant to complete residential drug treatment and aftercare in time for disposition of her pending charges. He can't have it both ways either, if he claims, which is that if the court is saying the court further ordered the defendant remain under the same terms and conditions of supervised probation, that gets us straight, if the court believes this is valid, that gets us back to our second argument, a second assignment of error, which is this order is further emphasizing that the court's initial intent was that she do these things and that was to be the end of her probation once she did it. And I bring this up just as so the court, and the court can see this. The order from 2010 was by Judge Ney. The probation violation was from Judge Kasabian, and unfortunately, Judge Ney did pass away. So this idea that the court is interpreting its own orders, we don't really know other than what Judge Ney said. What Judge Kasabian is doing is also reading into it from a different aspect. But
it's the same circuit court.
Correct, Your Honor. You're correct, Your Honor. It's the same trial court. And that's why that distinction really hasn't been made thus far. But it's clear that when she was, the indefinite probation was for her to complete these things, and once those things were done, she should have been off. But more importantly, I don't think the Commonwealth concedes this panel, unless you decide to take it en banc, needs to follow Wilson. Wilson is factually on point, and Wilson.
Well, but how do you get past the alternate argument, which by all rights is the best and narrowest for this court?
I don't think it's the best and narrowest. I think the best and narrowest, Your Honor, is to follow Wilson's decision, which finds that once probation is ended, a trial court loses jurisdiction. Defendants who are placed on probation, probationers, need to be able to know what those terms actually are. I see that my time is up. May I just briefly?
Yes.
And when we say that someone who has been convicted of a felony is now in perpetuity, without knowing if their probation ends, that they can still be on probation when the court acts after probation ends, that's a public policy issue that needs to be addressed as well. And I think that's part of why the Wilson court found the way it did. So I would ask the court that the best and narrowest is to hold under Wilson and to reverse this conviction.
Very well. In keeping with the tradition of this court, we will step down and greet counsel, and that will conclude the docket for the day. And so court stands adjourned.